So far we have been dealing with this introduction to differential geometry, and we have discussed many concepts in differential geometry like manifolds and tensors, how to differentiate these tensors, what lead derivative is, what forms are. So forms are very special types of tensors which are completely antisymmetric, and they have all indices down if you want. And they have very nice properties because they are special tensors. They have nice properties, and you can do more operations with them than with tensors, and so on. And I think the main result which we actually have from there, which combines all possible concepts here, is really the Cartan's lemma, which is the lead derivative with respect to the vector v of a p-form omega is just given by the inner derivative of d of omega and d of inner derivative of omega. Okay, and that's basically what will be used in classical mechanics, and half of the classical mechanics follows from this lemma. So very, very important. You will prove it today in tutorial. So just look forward to see how this works in practice. So now I'm gonna leave differential geometry to rest for some time. I'll let you to digest these concepts. We will not use them in next two lectures probably. Definitely not today, but we will heavily use them next week. So when we discuss symplectic geometry and other stuff. So please, you know, go through these concepts over the weekend and try to digest it and try to be familiar with these concepts, like what an exterior derivative is, what a form is, and so on. So now, today, I would like to start something which is perhaps more familiar to most of you, and I'll just review the Lagrangian, basic Lagrangian mechanics. And then maybe tomorrow I'll do Hamiltonian mechanics, and then we start putting these things into differential form language. Okay, so chapter 2 would be Lagrangian mechanics. And part A will be Hamilton's principle of least action. Okay. So let me just formulate it. So this principle is due to Hamilton, who lived between 1805 and 1865, but I think he formulated it something like 1829 or something like that, at the age of 25 or something like that. So you are nearly coming to that age, so it's time for you to discover something like this. Okay, so the principle states that the motions of the mechanical system in time interval in t goes from t1 to T2 coincide with the extremals of the action functional . And so this action functional is usually denoted by S. And it's so functional means it's a function of a function. So it's a function of your possible trajectories. So let's say that my trajectory is described by Q of T. And so this action is a function of these all these possible trajectories. And it's given by an integral from T1 to T2 of a Lagrangian, which can depend on Q, Q dot, and T, if you want, explicitly dt. And so the principle says, if I take this functional, I find its extremum, I will be able to find this trajectory Q. And so this L is called Lagrangian. Lagrangian, and it's some concrete function characterizing the system. So it'll be different for different systems. Okay, so who hasn't seen this before? Everybody has. That's very good. So I can go really quickly over this. So now, this is all very nice, but how to really derive the equation of motion from here? So to derive equations of motion, people usually consider a fixed endpoint variational problem. So that means that you fix your trajectory at t1 and you fix your trajectory at t2, and you proceed from there. So consider fixed endpoint fixed endpoints. What it means is that you are imposing that delta of q at t1 equals to 0 and delta of q at t2 equals to 0 as well. And so then what happens is displayed in this picture. So this is my q and this is my t. I fix what q is at time t1. I fix what q is at time t2. And then I consider all possible trajectories which go from that 1 to 2. So one of them can be something like this. Another one can be something like that, and so on. And so for any fixed time which lies in between t1 and t2, so this is my general time t. So let's denote the first one, the bottom one, will be q of t. And the upper one will be q of t plus delta q of t, when this guy is delta q of t. So this trajectory is q of t plus delta q of t. Okay, so I have two nearby trajectories which are separated by this delta. This is delta q of t. Okay, so that's the picture. And so what we are looking for, so we considered all these possible variations of the trajectories, and we would like to extremize this action here. So we seek for the extremum, which means that the delta of this action must be equal to 0. So seek extremum. That means that delta of S, which is S evaluated at Q plus delta Q minus S at Q equals to 0. So this is what we are looking for. Okay? And
for
so this.
For arbitrary delta Q.
In between T1 and T2. It is fixed at 1 and 2, but in between it's arbitrary. Yes? Okay? So now, let's do it. So let's calculate what delta S is. So delta S equals 2. So now you see that T is fixed during that variation, right? So I always consider, sorry for this, I always fix T, and then I consider the variation of delta Q. Okay, so T is fixed in the variation. And what it also means is that, for example, I can interchange delta and t, because they have nothing to each other. Delta goes in this direction, and dt goes in that direction, sort of. So you can always do that delta of d over dt is d over dt of delta acting on any function. So you'll be using this thing. So now I'll do it as a physicist, not as a mathematician. So t is fixed, so that means that this is an integral from t1 to t2, and the only thing which I can vary is the Lagrangian, because dt is fixed. So I have delta L and dt, which is an integral. So now I can vary L with respect to q, and delta q, I can vary it with respect to q dot, delta q dot, and that's it. So now, this guy, of course, is delta of dq over dt, but I can interchange, I can swap d. So this is the same thing as d over dt of delta q. And now I can integrate by parts. So I would like to shift the time derivative from this delta q to the other term.
So that's Lagrangian that has no explicit time.
Well, here I am doing variations with respect to q, so I don't really care about that.
Yeah, I guess that's
Yeah. But most Lagrangians won't depend explicitly on time, unless something screwed up comes in. But but here it doesn't really matter. Okay, so now I can integrate by parts. That means that I'll pick up a boundary term from this integration by parts, which is dl over dq dot and delta q, and that's evaluated at t2 and t1, and then plus the remaining integral, t1 and t2, and the first term is the same thing. I haven't done anything to that, and the second term has switched derivatives and a minus sign. And the whole thing is still delta q. Okay, and now I require that this is equal to 0 for any variations. So how can I do that? So first of all, I can look at this boundary term here, and I see that it really has the terms delta q evaluated at t1 and t2, but I imposed fixed endpoints. So this vanishes because of the fixed endpoints. Okay, and then I have this integral left. And so the only possibility, so that this is true for any delta q inside an interval t1 and t2, so the only possibility is that this guy is equal to 0, which gives you the famous Euler-Lagrange equations. So we conclude that we have dl over dq minus d over dt dl over dq dot equals to 0, and that's the famous Euler-Lagrange equations. I'll be just using shortcut E and L. Okay. So, any questions to this derivation? It's very simple. Okay, so now I've pretended that I have only one q, so let's say my motion is, if I have a pendulum, let's say it's described only by the angle phi, but of course you can have many of them. So you can put an index I here, and then you will have a set of equations where I runs from 1 to say n, if you have n degrees of freedom in the system. So now the trick that this all this works, and by the way, the Qs are called generalized coordinates, so they don't have to be Cartesian coordinates. They can be any suitable coordinates describing our describing our system. There is something which is called Occam's razor. So you want to choose only that many coordinates. As actually there are really degrees of freedom. So if you choose more coordinates, so let's say I want to describe the pendulum in terms of the Cartesian coordinates x and y instead of the angle phi, then that will have some constraints as well. And if you have constraints in the system, it becomes more complicated. So the simplest way and the most powerful way how to use Lagrangian formalism is really to choose only that many coordinates, how many degrees of freedom I truly have. And then I don't have any constraints, and I don't have to deal with them. Okay. Questions? So now let me make three remarks. So three. So first of them is that at this point I was just considering the possibility that L depends only on Q and Q dot and possibly T. And so the conclusion was that the Euler-Lagrange equations, as we have them written here explicitly, are second order. Okay. So now, of course, yes?
Isn't it a little strange conceptually to assume that you know where the particle is going to end up? Because you really seem to need that in the derivation.
Well, in practice, you are right. So in practice, usually you, let's say, measure initially the position and the velocity. But yeah, you can transfer one to another in some sense. It's just providing different boundary conditions or initial conditions. So, yeah.
Can you do this same derivation? And
it's a good question. I have never seen it. Maybe you can. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't like that about integral principles, but I think it's just because we're trained to think about, like, the first thing we learn are Newton's second law equation. We're trained to think about these things in terms of differential principles, right? So local variation law. But it's equally valid. I mean,
this entire framework is supposed to allow you to calculate, I measure my system now, and you want to predict where it is. And this seems to assume you already know where it is.
Yeah, but that's what I'm telling you. That the way you formulated the problem originally is a paradigm that doesn't need to be valid. You're sort of trained to think that given initial conditions, physics is about predicting the future, but you can.
So actually, Neil thinks that this is a completely wrong concept, that you shouldn't be thinking about initial data, but rather about thinking about here and there, and then asking what is the probability or what is the thing that you get from here to there. It makes more sense in quantum mechanics, and
sure.
Yeah. So people are trying to abandon that concept that really initial thing, position and velocity, is the crucial thing for physics. But I have never seen that starting from that principle. But it's an interesting question, man. Yeah. Okay, so that was the statement, is if we have Q and Q dot, and we have second order differential equation. So what happens if I put Q double dot there? What do you think? Yes?
Third order? I don't know.
Almost correct. So you will study this in your tutorial tomorrow. Almost correct. So you will have higher order equations of motion, which in principle is possible. Physicists don't like them because they usually have some pathologies and some problems. But there are physical equations which are more than second order. One of them is, for example, Fermi-Dirac equation for an accelerated electron. Okay, if you want to take into account the back reaction due to the radiation of electromagnetic fields, you need higher derivatives there. Okay, so let me leave that here. So now you can show, and I refer you to an excellent book by Landau and Lifshitz, that for conservative systems, if mechanical systems. L has very nice form, which can be written as kinetic energy minus the potential energy of the system. And there is beautiful derivation by Landau and Lifshitz, so look at that book if you are interested how this is done. Okay. Finally, there is some freedom in your choice of L. So in particular, so there is a freedom so if you choose L prime to be my original L plus a total derivative of a function, which is a function of coordinates and time, then I claim this gives the same equations of motion. Okay, so can anybody see that? I'll just show you a very simple proof. So you know, so to prove that, so your S prime is now L prime dt, which is the original one, L dt, plus the derivative d lambda over dt dt. But of course, this is just S plus, and now I just use the fundamental theorem, T1 and T2. So it's just lambda evaluated at T1 and T2. Okay. So now if you take the variation of this, it's almost correct proof what I'm doing here. Then you get, well, of course, this doesn't make sense to variate this thing. But anyway, let me do it. D lambda over dq delta q T2 and T1. And by my fixed endpoint condition, this is 0. So the variation of S prime is the same as variation of S and has to lead to the same Euler-Lagrange equations. An alternative proof would be take this Lagrangian, plug it directly into your Euler-Lagrange equation, and go through some painful differentiation, and find that in the end it gives the same thing.
Yeah, I see that this works, but this always leads me to think that, you know, that almost tells me I can add anything to my Lagrangian, because no matter what I have, I can just equate it to a derivative of lambda, and that gives me a first order differential equation.
Well, it's not anything, right? It's a total derivative. So that's something which is quite restrictive, right? So it's not everything can be written as a total derivative, I think.
Well, you just solve the differential equation, right? I mean, you said d lambda dt equals to whatever you're adding, and you solve it, and it's going to
because
happen.
Everything is function of t.
I mean, clearly I'm wrong. Just not sure.
Not about q is a function of t. I don't think it's that straightforward.
We can
do this.
Think of that.
Okay, so these are the three remarks. Any questions? So that's Hamilton's principle of least action. So second section on this will be integrals of motion. If you want to solve the Euler-Lagrange equations, you know, basically you have three possibilities. And so in your undergraduate courses, you have probably seen the first possibility where you actually can solve these equations, but it's very rare. So you can find an analytical solution. Well, this is actually possible only if the problem is actually integrable. Only if integrable. Not every problem is integrable. And Okay, I'll leave it to this thing. Then you can do it numerically. Or you can do it approximately. This leads to a perturbation theory, which I'm not going to discuss here. Numerically, you can do on your computer. So here, I'll be mostly interested in this analytical thing, but it's not so simple. So really, the problem has to be integrable. The equations have to be integrable. And they can be only integrable if there is sufficient, if they are sufficiently nice, if there are sufficiently enough integrals of motion. So need something which is called integrals of motion. So what is an integral of motion? So let's put a definition. An integral or constant of motion is a function let's call it I, which will be a function of q, q dot, and t, such that di over dt equals to 0 for any q of t solving my equations of motion. Okay, so it's something which basically doesn't change in time for any solution. Okay. And now everybody knows where I'm heading to. Of course, I'm heading to Noether's theorem. So Noether's theorem is this brilliant mathematician, Noether, who basically geometrized physics. So she was able to connect symmetries of your configuration space of dynamics with some properties of the motion, namely the integrals of motion. So Noether's theorem I will have something like 5 different versions of this theorem. So let's call this version 1, which is probably the most general one. Doesn't say really anything. So version 1 and says for every global continuous symmetry of the system, there is a corresponding integral of motion. Fundamental theorem there is in physics, although formulated by a mathematician who didn't care about physics. So just to be very, very specific and give you some examples, the simplest example, for example, will be that of generalized energy. So some examples. The first one, let's say that L is not an explicit function of T. it can depend on T, but only through Q. So if this is the case, then I claim that the following quantity E, which is dl over dq dot I q dot I minus L, is the integral of motion. And it's called generalized energy. Okay, so let me prove that. It's a one-line proof, so even I can do it. So dE over dt, so what is it equal to? So let me do it for I, just, well, let's forget about I, just one coordinate. Then I can do it. So d over dt, using the Leibniz rule, dl over dq dot, q dot, plus dl over dq dot, q double dot, that's differentiating the first term, minus dl over dq q dot minus dl over dq dot q double dot is differentiating the second term. And there is no, the last term dl over dt is not present there because L doesn't depend on time. So that was related to your question. So now obviously this term cancels that term. And if I put Q dot outside, I see that I have Euler-Lagrange equation. And so for a solution, this will be equal to zero. So provided Euler-Lagrange equations are satisfied. So even more simple example than this one is that of a generalized momentum. So the statement is, if L is not doesn't depend on some specific coordinate, let's say it doesn't depend on x or on y, this is called cyclic coordinate.
What is called cyclic coordinate?
L doesn't depend on some specific coordinates. Let's say it can depend on x, y, and z, but it doesn't depend on x, then you will call that x is a cyclic coordinate. So if this is the case, then starting at the Euler-Lagrange equation, which is somewhere here, so then with respect to that coordinate, dl over dq is equal to zero. So I have d over dt of something equals to zero, which means that that something has to be a constant. Okay. So then, Euler-Lagrange equations, let's call it something P, which is dl over dq dot, and this is a integral of motion called generalized momentum. This is where most of the undergraduate courses end. So let's now make it a little bit more complicated. Okay, yes?
Isn't there like a general method to actually see what the integral of motion is that corresponds to a certain symmetry?
So if you find a symmetry, you can find the corresponding.
Okay, that theorem just says there is one,
yeah.
Not how to find
one. I'll show you how to find one. So these, let's say I guessed these and then just verify that they are true. There is a procedure how to find them. But the most difficult part is actually to find what kind of symmetry, if there is any symmetry. Okay, so that's the difficult part. Yeah. If you guess what the conserved quantity is, then there is a procedure how to find what the corresponding symmetry is as well. Right? But yeah. So yeah. sometimes the symmetries actually can be hiding pretty well. So they are not obvious always.
If you observe that a certain quantity is conserved, can you find the corresponding symmetry?
Yeah, basically yes. If the quantity is nice, you will see much more. You will discuss this in more detail later on. Yeah. Yeah. So if the quantity is nice, yes, you can find the symmetry. Well, you can sort of find the symmetry always. But sometimes it's not.
I guess
it's not symmetry as you might expect it. It sounds very mysterious. Let's postpone.
Like, people typically, you know, you find a symmetry, then you derive the conserved quantity. But you know, I was asking if you can go the other way.
Yeah, usually you can do the other way around. If you have the conserved quantity, you take a Lie bracket or something like that, and you get the corresponding transformation, which leads to the symmetry. Yes. So. Let me put two remarks on terminology. So first of all, first remark is just really something which you should be familiar with, and it's a term on shell and off shell. Okay, so you say that something is valid on shell. On shell, and that means that something is valid provided the equations of motions are satisfied. That means provided equations of motion are satisfied. So all these E and P, they are integrals of motion on shell, only if the Euler-Lagrange equations are satisfied. And you've seen that in derivation, right? In both cases, I had to use, to show that the first line is equal to zero, I had to use the Euler-Lagrange equation. If that is not valid, then this is not conserved. So these are integrals of motion on shell for solutions, okay? And the opposite of this is off shell. Which means you don't need equation of motion. Okay, so that's first terminology, and this is very, very often used in field theory and whatever. So just it's better to get used to this already now. So second remark is what type of symmetries we have. Types of symmetries. And so you may notice that I use the words like continuous and global. So let me be very concrete and, you know, maybe not exhaustive, but so let me consider a transformation of coordinates, so for concreteness. I will use a transformation of coordinates such that t goes to t prime, which is equal to t plus delta t, and q goes to q prime at t prime, which is q of t plus delta of t. Okay, so now I'm actually, you know, if when you're finding a symmetry, Basically, what you are trying to do is that you take your action and do whatever to it so that in the end, the action actually remains the same. It doesn't change. Okay, so now I can change not only the coordinates, but I can change the time as well. So that's why this is a prototype of some kind of transformation I can do to find the symmetry. And so note also that here, this delta tilde is different from the delta before. So delta before, when it acted on time, I didn't allow any changes on time. I just delta didn't touch time before, in some sense. And here, so what is the difference? Is that before, I was comparing q and q prime at the same time t. And that's what you call delta. So now, you actually allow from the fact that the time can change as well. So this delta is different from that delta. And you will see very soon how different it is. And so now I'll do something which I don't know how to do it notationally, so I'll just write something very, very ugly. So I'll make an ansatz for what this delta q can be. And for that, I'll introduce some parameter, some parameter epsilon, and I allow to have k of these parameters, so this is an index. And then delta k of q, and the same for t. So this is really ugly, I apologize for that. Delta k of t. And so what I mean by these things is that when you are doing some kind of transformation, there is always a part which tells you what transformation you are doing. For example, that you are doing a rotation. And then there is a second part which tells you, you know, how much you rotate, right? So this thing, what I mean by these things, is the generator, something like a generator, which means, you know, what type of action I'm doing defines action. For example, I'm doing translation, I'm doing rotation, I'm doing something else. And the epsilon will be just the parameter. That determines how big the action is. You know, am I rotating 1 degree or 100 degrees, or am I moving 1 meter or 1 centimeter or so on. So how big the action is. Okay, very ugly notation, many apologies for this.
Do you mean q prime t or do you mean q prime t prime?
I try to stress that on the right hand side, so you have q prime of t prime on the left hand side, and on the right hand side you have the original q of t. So it's a different t now. You can change t now. So you don't have to only change coordinates, but you can also change, describing my system, but also change the time. So, yeah. All right, so once we have this ugly notation here, then based on what actually epsilon is, you can distinguish different types of symmetries. So symmetries can be either discrete or continuous. So discrete symmetry, for example, take a square and ask, you know, does it have any rotational symmetry? And of course, it does have rotational symmetry, but only if I rotate by 90 degrees. if I rotate less than 90 degrees, then I don't bring it into the same position as it was before. So this is a discrete symmetry, whereas if I take a circle, then I can rotate it around any epsilon, and still it's the same thing. So this guy actually is now continuous. So basically, depending on what this epsilon is, if it can be continuous, then I can call this symmetry a continuous symmetry. If it has to be discrete or whatever, some specific value, then I call the symmetry discrete symmetry. Also, another classification of symmetries is this global or local. So global symmetry means that this epsilon is constant, epsilon I are constant. They don't depend on time. So let's say I move everything 1 centimeter, no matter at which time this is true. And the local symmetry, epsilon I, depend on t. So I allow these transformations to depend on time. Okay. So now we understand what are the conditions for this Noether's theorem. So we say for every global and continuous symmetry. So if you have, for example, a discrete symmetry, there is no conserved charge to it. Okay, so it has to be really continuous, and it has to be global symmetry so that you have these conserved charges. If you have local symmetry, you have second Noether's theorem, and you have some kind of identity which is satisfied always off-shell for your equations of motion. It's called Bianchi identity, but it doesn't give you integral for motion. Okay, so really, so we need this, and we need that. And then we have a symmetry. Then we have an integral of motion. Questions?
Why is local that it depends on t and not that it depends on space-time?
Of course, well, in field theory, it will depend on space-time. Yes. So, yeah. So here, what you are doing is, that, for example, you are rotating a thing, right? And so
you're
the question
rotating
is,
your path.
You're
rotating the path that you're following.
You are rotating the whole system. So for example, the question is, does my system have a rotational symmetry, right? So if I twist the system, does it look the same as it was before?
Okay.
Okay. And so I will say the symmetry is global. If yes, I can do for any constant epsilon, which is constant in all times, for all times, there will be this symmetry. Okay? On the other hand, if I have to tune that this epsilon actually depends on time, so I have to tune it at one time, it will be like that, at another time, it will be like that, then it's not as powerful. But you are right. In field theory, local means that these epsilons will depend on space-time. But then you are talking about fields living on the space-time. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so equipped with this notation, I can give you a second version of Noether's theorem. Okay, so Noether theorem. Because it uses this ugly notation, I call it an ugly version. So version 2, which is the ugly version. It's an ugly version, but it's also, you know, it gives you way how to calculate something. So I think it's still useful. So a statement is let delta tilde be a global continuous symmetry. So now let me specify what I mean by that. That is off shell we find delta tilde t and delta tilde q such that the variation of my action is equal to zero, so that under these variations off shell, I'm not using equations of motion, but I get that the action doesn't change. Then the statement is that the following beast so then I equal to dl over dq dot delta q plus l minus q dot dl over dq dot delta t is the integral of motion. Is m okay. So that's the second version of Noether's theorem. So now really notice the subtlety here. So in order to find the symmetry, so in order to you know, you guess some delta t and delta q, and you have to verify that this delta tilde s is equal to zero off shell. So you are not allowed to use equations of motion. Only then it's a true symmetry of the system. It has nothing to do with the motion. Symmetry is simply I rotate the system and it looks the same, and has nothing to do with the actual motion of, in the system. Okay, so this must be valid off shell. And then the statement is, if this is true off-shell, without equations of motion, then this quantity here will be preserved in time on solutions, on-shell. Okay, so that's the statement of Noether's theorem.
I'm not sure what, so your integral of motion is going to have epsilons and dqs and dts in it?
So is these delta, so this will be something concrete. We will see in tutorial tomorrow what these things are concretely, right? But yeah, basically you are doing the transformation. You are saying I have to plug into the action this instead of t, I'm plugging t prime, which is t plus delta t, where delta t is some concrete function of something, and the same thing for q. So I'm doing that transformation to all the coordinates and the time and everything, and I have to find that the action is conserved.
Sure.
Off shell. No equations of motion. Okay. So now so why is this really geometrizes physics? Is that again we can have some examples of this. Again, this is stupid notation, but example, so let's say I choose delta tilde t and delta tilde q to be epsilon 1 and 0. So I'm actually changing time only, I'm shifting time, but I'm not doing anything with the coordinates. And if you find that this is indeed a symmetry, so this corresponds to time translation, you translate in time. And so if this is a symmetry, it gives you the energy. Then I is the energy. Energy is something which is connected with time. On the other hand, if I just move in space, zero and one. So then I do space translation. Translation and then I is the momentum. And so usually you have these integrals of motion because the space-time is actually homogeneous. Third example would be where my generalized coordinate is an angle. So I have delta t and I have delta phi of an angle. So I have to do it's equal to epsilon 0 and 1. So I'm just making it corresponds to a rotation.
In the case of time translation, when you vary t, you also vary q through t. I'm just thinking about deriving.
It's not a bad.
Yeah,
well,
but q is still a function of t, right? So if
no,
t,
I don't think it's variable. It's just space itself, not bad.
I seem to recall that when you derive that, you also vary q through t.
You will see this explicitly tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So you know, to derive all these things, you will see explicitly what you have to do.
Right.
So that, yeah. It'll all be clear after the tutorial, I hope. So then I is the angular momentum. Momentum, and that means isotropy of the space-time. Okay. So it's just an example of what type of symmetries you may have. So now, I don't know if I have, well, I have time to do proof and maybe. So proof of this statement is relatively ugly because the statement is ugly, but let me do it. And the nice thing about that proof, the only nice thing, is that it actually explains what is the difference between delta and delta tilde. So for that, and it's related to your question as well, you know, what am I doing when I'm doing these things? But I still think it's best, you know, to do it on a concrete example. But okay, so let's do the proof of this second version of Noether's theorem. Maybe there's a simple proof, but let's do this one. So first, what is the, you know, how delta is related to delta tilde? So that's the first thing which we have to clarify. So for time, it doesn't really matter. So delta tilde of dt is just defined as dt prime minus dt. So now these things commute. So this is d delta tilde of t, which is d delta tilde of t dt dt. So there's no problem here. More interesting situation is when delta tilde actually acts on my q. So then you have delta tilde q, and let me write explicitly t. So by the definition which I used over there, and somebody asked whether I made a mistake or not really, this is really q prime t prime minus q of t. Okay, so it's q prime and t prime. Okay, so now on the first term, I can use the Taylor expansion. So I will write t prime in terms of t and the other terms. So this will be equal to q prime at t. And then the difference between t prime and t is just delta t. So it's plus delta tilde t d q prime of t over dt and plus other terms in the Taylor expansion, and then minus Q of t. Okay, so I'm Taylor expanding the first term around that t prime and evaluating it at t. Okay, so this is good. So now if you look at this term and that term, you see now that the arguments are now the same. So you have q prime of t minus q of t, which is precisely what you meant by delta in the previous thing. Not delta tilde, by delta. So this is equal to delta q of t, and then plus the other term, delta t. And then you want to relate q prime to q. Okay. So again, they are somehow infinitesimally related. So I can, in the first approximation, write dq of t over dt, and then plus higher order terms, because then there will be this difference between q prime and q. It's small, but it's already multiplied by a small thing here. So these are higher order terms. So we can write it in the first approximation as this thing. Okay. Or if I just tear the q out, I will have delta plus delta t d over dt acting on q of t plus other terms. So you see that actually delta tilde, at least in this case, but in fact much more generally, for any function of q is equal to this operator identity. Okay, that's what we just derived. So far, so good? Okay, so that was the difficult part of the theorem, or maybe the eliminating part of the theorem, of the proof of the theorem. So now let's just go through the calculation and see how we can use this. All right. So we want to calculate what delta S is. And so now this is an integral, and we have L dt. But because delta tilde can act on t and L, we have now two terms. Okay, so this is delta tilde L dt plus L delta tilde dt. So it's now two terms, because we can change time now. So by the way, the requirement is that this is off-shell equal to 0. So just let's remember that this must be equal to 0 in the end. Okay. So using the identity which we just derived, you'll apply it on this first term here. So this is equal to delta L plus delta tilde t dl over dt, the whole thing multiplied by dt. What's going on here? Delta t plus L delta tilde dt over dt dt. Okay, so I just use this identity here. So now you can observe, if you look at these two terms, they are a total derivative. So you can write these two terms as d over dt of delta tilde t and L. Okay, so these two terms are fine. So now funny business happens with this term. So let's calculate this term somewhere. So delta L, okay, it's delta L over delta Q dot, plus delta L over dq, delta Q. And then you can write it as a total derivative dl over dq dot q dot. So dl over dq dot q dot. Interesting. Delta q dot. Well, let me write it. And maybe it's true. D over dt, dl over dq dot, delta q, and then plus dl over dq, delta q. Is this true? Maybe not. Delta q dot. Is it true? Maybe it is. Mm-hmm. So we have.
Are you just gonna end up with the first term, but with the q replaced by q dot? That's all.
Is the q replaced by q dot? So this total derivative should, you know, reduce this thing.
And is there supposed to be a delta in the first term somewhere?
Mm-hmm. Del over dq dot q double dot. I'm getting q double dot somewhere.
Yeah, the first one that.
And I'm still getting one more dot, which is not good. So maybe it's this all dot. Is this true now? Delta Q could be true.
Yeah.
Thanks. All right. So now you plug this expression for delta L over here. Okay. And then you notice that there are some terms which actually are a total derivative, and you collect those terms to a common term, and then you put all the other terms to something else. Okay, so this is equal to putting all these terms together. So you have d over dt, and then dl over dq dot delta q plus l delta t, which is this term here and that term here, and then plus dl over dq minus d over dt, and you already recognize the Euler Lagrange notation. Delta q, and the whole thing is dt. Okay? Well, hallelujah. So on shell, this is equal to 0. So if I define this thing I, then because it's a total derivative, it means that I at t1 is the same as I at t2, because the whole thing equals to 0. Okay? So on shell, this term vanishes. And then this is a total derivative, so I write it as I at t2 minus I at t1, but it's equal to 0 because it's a symmetry. Okay, so now I conclude that I is, well, that this is the integral of motion. So now it still doesn't look like whatever I wrote there, but it's almost like that. If you replace this delta q by using that identity with delta tilde q. So you have to apply now that identity over there on this I, and you recover this formula here. And so that's the end of the proof. So really, you know, if you find such transformations, delta t, delta tilde t, and delta tilde q, so that the action doesn't change, then that is your prescription for how to find the integral of motion. Okay, so that's going one way. So there's the other way as well. Once you know the integral of motion, you can find the corresponding transformations. So really, the most difficult part is to find what is the symmetry? What transformations actually don't change S? And people can spend lifetime doing that for complicated systems. And if you find it, well, you are a famous person, and the system is named after you. Okay, but it's not always exists. Okay, so that's the second version of the null test theorem. And I think, although ugly, it's quite explicit. So now there is this very elegant version, which, however, doesn't make any sense. Okay, I will mention now this formulation of null test theorem. And again, you will have opportunity in your tutorial to practice that version as well. So let me just state it. And it's a version which is loved by field theories and field theorists and string theorists and all these people. But it's, you know, it's very sneaky. Okay, so null test theorem version 3, and I would say it's a sneaky recipe. Okay, and so basically this is really a recipe. It doesn't give you an explicit formula or anything. It just gives you how to, for a concrete system, how to find your integral of motion. So it consists of several steps. So the first step is, you know, observe that your action S is invariant. Under, again, a global continuous symmetry, continuous transformation, and so again, the global means that these epsilon I are constant. We then have that delta S equals to 0. Okay, so that's the first observation. Again, the recipe doesn't tell you how to do that, and it's a difficult task in general. But let's say we have that already. Okay, so we have some transformation, which is global and continuous, and we have that. So now the second step is insane. I think it's completely insane. So now we say epsilon I, so this is true for continuous symmetry and the global one. Now you say, well, what happens if this transformation is actually local? So now, second step is promote epsilon I to epsilon I of t. So now we are making them local, okay? And we are imposing, moreover, on this epsilon I the fixed endpoint conditions. Okay. Then, okay, so then obviously delta S is not equal to 0 anymore, because it was only equal to 0 for a global thing. But it's not hard to see that this is the most general form which can happen. So then delta S is equal to delta T epsilon dot of I, and then whatever remains there. Okay. So what I'm saying is that if I promote epsilon I to a function of time, then delta S is infinitesimal, so everything here must be infinitesimal. So I'm neglecting all the terms epsilon square and epsilon cube and so on. So the first term is epsilon, and this has to vanish if epsilon is a constant. So if it's not a constant, it must be proportional to epsilon dot. Okay, so this is what it is. Okay, so then this is true.
What's the last symbol?
And so this is everything else. Everything, what, you know. So the statement is, you can always write it in this form, where, you know, this is proportional to epsilon dot, and then whatever remains out of this delta S. Okay. So this is the most general form, which is linear in epsilon, and vanishes if epsilon is a constant. Okay. So now the statement is, once you write it in this form, you are done, because the statement is these are the integrals of motion, not their charges, if you want. Not their integral. Okay? So really, the recipe says, massage the action when epsilon is a function of time into this form, and then this will be the Noether charge. So now, this is not easy to see that indeed it is a Noether's charge. And so how you see that, so bar three, to see this, you integrate by parts whatever you have here. So then you have delta S tilde equals 2, so by parts, integrate by parts. And you have delta S tilde is minus, and now dt di I over dt epsilon I. And then there is a boundary term, but the boundary term is not there because I imposed this fixed endpoint conditions on epsilon. Okay? So now this thing must be equal to 0 on shell. Why? The reason why this is equal to 0 on shell is that now epsilon I are function of time. So what this is just a normal variation of the action under delta qi, which is epsilon equal to epsilon I. This is delta qi, which is equal to epsilon I. You can think about it this way, that this is a completely general variation now. And so whatever, through the action principle, you know, this must be equal to 0. Okay. But this must be true for any epsilon. And so now this is a trick which I still don't understand. But people say, well, now I can choose any epsilon I want. So why not to choose a constant epsilon? So epsilon I now choose a constant. But you require that it's still equal to 0. So the only possibility how this is equal to 0 for constant epsilon is that dii over dt equals to 0. Okay, so this is the way how to see this. I think it's very, very sneaky recipe and very, okay. So there is a recent discussion of this recipe. It's a paper which about 3 months ago by a good guy. So I put a reference in the study in the study text where he basically discusses why this works and why when it doesn't work and what actually is going on in this sneaky recipe. So if you are interested, go ahead and read that link. And otherwise, let me finish here. So questions? So we have three versions of Noether theorem. We will have much nicer version next week in Hamiltonian formalism and in differential geometry formalism. But yeah.